rebuilding the middle class, there's really kind of two pieces to it. Like I said, there's this $51 trillion transfer of wealth, with a T, which is a mind-boggling amount of money, from the middle class to the top 1%. We've got to get some of that back down into the middle class.
Why are today's liberals so bad at making the case for the retransfer of wealth back to the middle class? Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. We have a great conversation lined up for you today. And certainly, I have to say up front, if you love the podcast, please tell your friends about it. Share the love for this brother. I appreciate it when you do. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts. Do the download thing. It all works. It all works. It makes me feel all yummy inside. You can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele and the podcast on Twitter at Steele_podcast. This podcast is part of the Bulwark Network. I'm so happy this is now a week into being a part of the Bulwark family, and I'm so glad to be a part of the work here at the Bulwark. You can find them on social media at Bulwark Online. So today I wanted to have a conversation with someone who has been a liberal, knows liberalism, the progressive movement from a more traditional perspective, if you will. He is an author, a businessman, radio personality, and progressive political commentator, none other than Tom Hartman. He has been the nation's number one progressive talk show host for over a decade. And his radio show, The Tom Hartman Program, reaches over 7 million listeners per week. It is a real treat for me to have Tom on the show to not just talk about, oh, what's happening with Biden, but to really kind of put into some context traditional liberalism and its view on the economy, the working class, and why that's translating or not translating as well today. So stay tuned for, I think, what will be an enjoyable conversation. I'm so glad you're with us. Right here on the Michael Steele Podcast, we're going to come back with Tom right after this.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast as we are in the beginning of our, actually, maybe in the middle of our summer. I mean, I just feel like, you know, we just started it, but it's already July. Here we are. And a lot of crazy stuff is happening right now in our politics, and we'll get into all of that. I'm excited to welcome to the conversation someone that many of you are familiar with, as he hosts a program that reaches well over 7 million listeners every week, none other than Tom Hartman from the Tom Hartman Program. Tom, it's so great to have you, man.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you.
I appreciate
you,
brother.
I love the work you do on MSNBC.
Yeah. We have a lot of fun in that space. And you probably have a lot of fun in what you're doing right now in terms of reaching so many Americans, day-to-day folks out there. Just top line before we get into some of the meat of it, what is your sense of the American psyche related to this political environment we're in, the economy, things that are going on in their lives? What are they telling you? What are you hearing?
Yeah, you know, I think the problem or the situation or whatever, the crisis actually that America is facing right now, in some ways dates back to Reagan, you know, kind of reorganizing America. I mean, just saying, okay, we're going to go with neoliberalism as opposed to classical liberalism. We're going to abandon FDR and we're going to, you know, we're going to go to free trade and austerity and mm-hmm. lower taxes for rich people and anti-union and all those kind of things. And what that did was it created over the 40 years following it a steady disconnect where the middle class of America went from being over 60% of us to now it's between 43 and 47% of us, depending on whose numbers you're using. And, you know, the average rent in the United States is $2,000 a month. And so you really had to earn about $75,000 a year to be able to comfortably have that be right. the appropriate part of your after-tax income. But, you know, the top average income is around 50. So that's very different from the world that I grew up in, you know, in the 1950s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And that my father, who worked in a tool and die shop his whole life, was able to raise four boys and, you know, put kids through college and buy a home and everything. I mean, you know, just so that world has changed. And what that did is it created a space for a lot of demagoguery. And Donald Trump stepped into that space in a big way. I think starting really with the election of President Obama. And, you know, a good chunk of it, of course, was Trump's just naked racism. Right. But beyond that, he was also smart enough, as reluctant as I am to use that phrase, to know that the American middle class was taking it, you know, was being hurt by this neoliberalism, which, by the way, was happening with both parties. You know, Bill Clinton signed on for this, too.
And, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Obama. You know, in fact, Joe Biden is the first president in my lifetime since really the first 2 years of Jimmy Carter. I mean, Jimmy Carter signed on for neoliberalism. He deregulated the airlines and the right. railroads in the last 2 years of his presidency, really since Lyndon Johnson. You know, I mean, so I think that the damage that neoliberalism has done to the American middle class. Everybody's looking for ways to point fingers. And, you know, like Trump, you know, the other day saying, oh, those immigrants want to take black jobs or they want to take, you know, the white.
Yeah,
job,
we're still trying to figure out exactly what a black job is.
Yeah, I suspect
what I'm doing right now may qualify. I'm not sure.
I think you qualify.
You know, dude, we're working on that.
But this is the thing. I mean, this is a game that they've been playing, and you know, for two centuries in this country, which you know is playing groups off each other, and you know, using the cheap, easy stuff: race, religion, regionality, gender, age.
I mean, it has. I think to your point, Tom, it has become much more specific in that regard, and I definitely accept your point that Joe Biden is probably the next in the link, direct link to, you know, Roosevelt, Johnson, and Biden. If you want to just sort of look at that line of classical, traditional liberalism.
Keynesian economics, really.
Keynesian, exactly. Well put. And so you do have that. And it really kind of goes to the heart of what Joe Biden has been arguing from the very beginning of his presidency around policies like infrastructure, for example, and the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, what he's doing, what he has done with student loan debt, for example. So why aren't Americans, and you know, probably many of your listeners sitting there going, you know what, this economy sucks. Yeah, you know, I had a friend of mine say that to me recently, and I was like, dude, you're about to take a $10,000 vacation. How bad is your economy?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, when you ask people, how are you doing? Most people say fine. I think the number's over 70%. When you ask them how they think the economy is doing, they say it's terrible. And you know, I think that that's just kind of the propaganda wars. You've got the GOP is, you know, trash talking Biden because, right. you know, for political gain. Which you expect, and Trump bragged an awful lot when he was president about, you know, things that weren't actually true. I mean, you know, he didn't create more jobs than Obama did. He certainly the economy was not the best that ever. You know, I mean, he was just so good at exaggerating that stuff, and people bought it. But I don't know how to punch through that. You know, I mean, I think the people who listen to my program on, you know, SiriusXM and radio stations around the country and on Free Speech TV and whatnot, I think, you know, they get it that the economy is doing pretty good, but we're still digging out of this hole that 40-year austerity policy or neoliberalism policy or whatever you want to call it, you know, unfortunately, Reaganism, but like I said, it was both parties bought into it for so long. We're still digging out of that hole, and we've got a long way to go.
But you know, the interesting thing, but here's the irony about, you know, I think kind of putting the Reaganism cap, or you know, bottle cap on the bottle, on the economic bottle, is that you did have an unprecedented amount of spending that sort of drove a lot of those underlying narratives. Now, admittedly, and I raised my hand as the first one to say, having been in many of these rooms at the time, you know, Republicans who rail against, you know, big government spending as they did under the Bush years, and you know, wanted to turn their backs on him in 2006 because of it, have been the largest perpetrators of government expense and government spending. When you look at it, between Democratic and Republican administrations. But certainly since Obama, you have seen more of a leveling between the two parties in that space. What does that tell you? Are we sort of stuck in this sort of you know, chasing our tails kind of environment with respect to the economy and spending for both sides? There's always some reason, whether it's COVID, whether it's, you know, a housing crisis, whether it's pick your poison, which we've had both of those since 2008. What do you account for us not being able to break that cycle, and why do Democrats seemingly fall into perpetuating it?
I think it's a question of power and you know, of who's being served by the economy. There's been a $51 trillion transfer of wealth from the American middle class starting in 1981 into the pockets of the top 1%. The last time we saw that in the United States, or something close to that, it was, you know, proportionate, maybe a third of that, proportionally, was in the era from 1920 to 1933.
Yeah, I was going to say right before the crash, right?
Exactly. And you know, it was called the Roaring Twenties because the rich
The
were just
robber
getting
barons.
mind-boggling rich. Exactly. But average working people were actually hurting throughout the 20s. And you know, particularly the Coolidge and ultimately the Hoover administration. But I mean, Harding started that. He dropped the top income tax rate from 91% down to 25%. That was his big campaign thing. His campaign slogan was horses and sparrow economics. You know, if you feed the horses extra oats, the horse poop that ends up on the roads, which back in 1920 made a lot of sense to people, will have a lot of extra oats, and the sparrows will eat them. And you know, now we call it trickle down economics. It's, you know, pour a little extra wine on the top, and it'll. But the bottom line is that because of that massive transfer of wealth, we have this struggling middle class and a poor class below the middle class economically as well. And so it's really about power. It's about the power of labor. And what happened in the period from 1933 until 1985, really, when Reaganism really started to bite, you know, when the unions really started to go down in flames. I mean, when Reagan came into office, about a third of America was unionized, which meant two-thirds of America had the equivalent of a good union job, because the union job set the local wage floor. You know, by the end of the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, your unionization density had gone from about a third of America down to what, around 13 or 14%. I think it's around 11% now. And it's not just about unions or not unions. It's about who has the power to determine where the money goes.
But is it, but on that point, but on that point, Tom, what didn't you also have? Because I agree with you from a public policy standpoint, there was a clear shift. And those of us in the early days of Reagan conservatism, particularly economic conservatism, made that case for trickle down, right? And in the belief and understanding that wealth created here can only go down, it can't go up, right? It won't go sideways, it'll only go down. And we now know that that's not necessarily how it works, and appreciate that. But with respect to unions, I remember as a young man becoming more and more anti-union as a citizen. I mean, before I even really got into the throes of politics and taking a hardened political position, based off of the behavior of unions. And so as much as the public policy changed in one direction, you also had the public perception of unions change based off of their own behavior in how they treated their own, what their expectations were. And I do remember a number of big arguments around the idea of dues, right? All of a sudden, now you had union members who were like, well, what are you doing with my money, number one? And I don't want my money necessarily to go to that candidate or to that cause. So you have this sort of creation within this, this ecosystem of various other ideas and approaches emerging in a way that disrupted that, in addition to what was happening from a public policy standpoint, which just really kind of furthered that. I mean, how did you see that part of it? Not, look, I'm not putting the blame on unions, because I know that's silly argument, absolutely, to make that case. But I'm just saying that there were a lot of things that were kind of happening culturally, politically, socially, and certainly economically, that were kind of moving and reshaping during the 80s, what would be the setup pitch in the 90s and 2000s that culminated in what we see playing out today.
Yeah. Yeah. And you make a really good point. And, people like Rush Limbaugh in the 80s really amplified that.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, that was one, how I first got a, you know, conservatives had this thing, little thing called talk radio that nobody really paid attention to. And that's where a lot of that kind of got spoon fed to a lot of folks at that time, to your point.
Right. But this goes to the idea of, you know, how power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. As the unions, as the union movement created the American middle class, you can argue that there was a certain amount of government spending, Eisenhower in particular, sure, building schools and building hospitals,
highways and stuff like that. Highway system.
Right. You build out the infrastructure and then business fills it in. So, you know, that certainly grew the economy. But the thing that really built the American middle class was the unions. And the union. And so what happened was, you started seeing unions getting very, very corrupt. You know, Frank Fitzsimmons and Jimmy Hoffa and these guys. I grew up in Michigan. I mean, my dad worked in a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan. And I know James Hoffa, you know, Jimmy's son. I never knew Jimmy. There was just an enormous amount of corruption. I mean, Jimmy Hoffa gave Richard Nixon $500,000 in cash to drop the prosecution of the Sun Valley land deal in 1960. Right. Nixon was running against Kennedy in 1960.
Yeah, and for president, right?
Yeah, and the mob, you know, the interaction of the mob with the unions was starting to become public in the 60s as well, you know, with that kind of stuff. So I lived in Germany for a year in the 80s, and what I thought was fascinating about that, which is heavily unionized, and they have a law that every company that has more than 2,000 employees, 50% of their board of directors has to be made up of union members. Huh. The unions are well integrated into government and into society in ways that essentially have checks and balances. It's real difficult for a German union or a German union leader to be corrupt. In the 60s, it was very easy and 70s and 80s, it was very easy for American union leaders to be corrupt. And that was, you know, that was something that the Reagan's movement used to beat up the unions with,
right?
And it was a hard
argument. Well, the air traffic controller strike was really kind of the tip off, play where
that was the declaration of war.
Exactly, and which is ironic coming from a union man, because Reagan was a union guy, You know, he's part of, you know, the Hollywood Union community. And
although he was also, you know, J. Edgar Hoover's informant.
Well, there was that. There was that. Just a little bit of spycraft going on as well. Look, it's fat. Go ahead.
But I think that if we could get back to a reasonable union density, you know, something approaching 30-40%. I mean, most of Europe, you know, you see union densities of 70-80%, you know, really substantially high union density. Right. But like I said, you don't see corruption in the unions because they're.
Do you see that happening?
They're by law. Not in the United States, as long as the GOP fights it so vigorously and the Democratic Party is only now just starting. I mean, Joe Biden is literally the first president to walk a picket
line. So that was
a
big deal.
It's kind of shocking when you think about it. I mean, yeah, the Kennedy didn't do that or Johnson didn't do that or whatever. But our union movement has always been this kind of this libertarian streak in America. And the union movement has never been other, you know, it's always been kind of its own independent little empire. And I think we need to kind of, well, not kind of, I think we need to be rethinking the structure of unions. And I think there's some really good examples that you find in particularly in the Northern European countries of how to do that. And I think that to a large extent, that's going to be a key. And that's why one of the reasons that we're starting to see the economy do so well on under Biden in particular, but really over the last 8-10 years, let's say since the crash, since 2005, right, 2006, or 2008, because people are, a generation has grown up that doesn't think of unions as Jimmy Hoffa and corrupt.
So you have a chance to remake that landscape a little bit and to redefine what a union is versus what up to this point has been defined.
Right. And you look at today's union leaders and they're really good people. I mean, you know, they're not connected to the mob anymore, and they're not, you know, and I mean, even some of the really old unions that were terribly corrupt long time ago, you know, like the longshoremen, have cleaned up their act. I mean, they've really got their act together in many regards. And the extent to which we can build that, I think, you know, that building that, rebuilding the middle class, there's really kind of two pieces to it. Like I said, there's this $51 trillion transfer of wealth, with a T, which is a mind-boggling amount of money, from the middle class to the top 1%. We've got to get some of that back down into the middle class. You know, I mean, we've got three men in the United States who own as much wealth as half of America. Like I said, the last time we saw that was 1931. And it wasn't even that bad in 31, but, you know, it was pretty.
So answer this for me. In the face of everything we know, and certainly what you've been saying in the last few minutes, why are today's liberals so bad at making the case for the very thing you just said, for, you know, the retransfer of wealth back to the middle class as the foundational underpinning of our economy, which it has been from its founding. It's something the founders were very much keyed in on. In fact, one of the things that drove them out of England was not just the oppressive nature of the government itself, but the wealth. But then, of course, a lot of them were wealthy men too, so they wanted to confine and constrict that a little bit.
The richest of the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence was John Hancock, and his net wealth at that time in $2,000. I got this out of Kevin Phillips' book, so at the recalibrated, but he had a net worth of $700,000. Yeah. I mean, that's upper middle class.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the kind of rich that we have now.
Today.
There were.
So how do they make the case? How do liberals make the case? And when you're looking at, I mean, because right now, and we haven't gotten into it, we will in a moment, the whole thing with Biden stepping off the ticket after everything he's done to position the party to actually kick ass this November, right?
Yeah.
Now everybody's fixated on the man's age, like an 81-year-old guy, like the 77-year-old guy they nominated wouldn't be 81 4 years later. Yeah. And then they renominate him again. So you have all of this, ignoring the nature of the success since arguably Johnson, President Lyndon Johnson, and certainly hearkening back to, again, is that, as I mentioned before, part of that lineage of Franklin Roosevelt, and yet and still today's liberals aren't ready to rally around that case to be made, because everyone's not only focused on his age, Tom, but they're all those saying, well, tell us what you're going to do for the future, and will you live long enough to do it?
Yeah. Well, I think
it's such a bullshit. I'm like, guys, come on. But anyway,
I'm with you. Yeah. I think we need to disentangle
things there.
I mean, you know, there's the policy stuff, and Biden is talking about unions and talking about the middle class and talking about, you know, bringing back relatively high tax rates on, you know, that, I mean, CEOs used to make on average, in fact, in 1980, when Reagan came into office, the average CEO made 30 times what the average worker did. You know, now it's 500 times or thereabouts. I mean, it depends on the industry you look at. In some industries, it's thousands of times. So we need to rebalance taxes. But part of that has to do with this power equation, which brings us back to things like unions and the Democratic Party and the movement. I think that the Democratic Party in general and liberals in general have been making a pretty good case, at least for unions and at least for, you know, raising taxes back to the point where, you know, just massive theft of wealth by a very small number of people is just no longer possible, or you've got a pretty high level of public outrage going on right now.
Right.
A lot of it is misdirected or is being manipulated, shall we say. But that's a whole completely different thing about than, you know, is Joe Biden too old to run for president? I personally think that he's doing a great job as president, and I don't think he's too old to be president.
Right.
He is, however, I do, and this concerns me. I'm not specifically, although I did write an op-ed a couple of weeks ago about this, but I'm becoming a little more sanguine. I you know, people want a leader.
Is that after
people
drinking some sangria, or is that just, how do you
say right now? I'll tell you. People want people want a leader who is going to protect them. They want somebody who is going to fight for them. They want somebody, and that requires a certain projection of strength. And you know, up until recently, Biden has been able to do that, but lately his ability to project leadership and strength, he's saying the right words. I mean, when you read his speeches, they're incredible. Even his off-the-cuff remarks are in some cases extraordinary.
Right.
But his presentation is getting enfeebled is a probably too strong a word, but you understand what I'm saying.
I do, yeah.
That's his principal vulnerability to Trump, is that Trump comes across as confident and cocky, and people are like, oh, well, you know, if we have to go into a war, or if we're in an economic war with China, or if we're, you know, or if just, you know, those people want to hurt me, this guy is going to fight for me. This guy, right. Whereas this other guy, he's having a hard time getting the words out, you know, right. Is he going to fight for me? And that's what concerns me. And there's not much talk about that, frankly, because that's really kind of in the field of psychology, political psychology, as opposed to policy. Because I think, you know, policy-wise, Biden has been brilliant. One of the best presidents of my lifetime, and I've been around a long time.
You've been around a long time. Yeah, well, and a part of that, I want to delve into. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get into, because you didn't grow up in this, like, you know, left-wing progressive household. You've got some conservative roots that are kind of rummaging there, and we want to explore how that shaped your view today and how you see things moving forward. We're having wonderful conversation with nationally syndicated host of the Tom Hartman program, Tom Hartman. We'll be right back right after this.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm really enjoying this conversation with Tom because it's important, Tom Hartman, to have this this view from other seats in the arena. And, you know, a lot of times people have preconceived ideas about someone like you coming from a progressive point of view, certainly someone like me coming from a more conservative point of view. And what they don't know or maybe fully appreciate in our personal development is that's not necessarily where we started. I grew up in a moderately liberal household in Washington, D.C. You grew up in a more traditional or staunch Republican household. Your daddy was, out there for Barry Goldwater in 64. Talk about that as sort of a foundational underpinning that helps you appreciate moments like we're in right now and the value of making the case.
In 1964, I was 13 years old and I went door to door with my dad for Barry Goldwater. The year before, he had given me a copy of John Starmer's book, None Dare Call It Treason. And I was convinced that, the communists were in the State Department, that they were preparing to take over America. And, my dad he took me to a John Birch Society meeting once and he said, I'm just taking you to this meeting because I want you to meet the crazies. You need to know.
Because they were crazy.
they really were. And that was back when Fred Koch was funding it and they were putting up these billboards all over Michigan that, impeach Earl Warren. And that was because of Brown versus Board. Mm-hmm. So my dad wasn't, like a fire breathing conservative. He was an Eisenhower conservative. He was an Eisenhower Republican.
Yeah.
And in fact, when he was dying in our living room, I was sitting with him and I had my hand on his shoulder and I looked across the room and there were his two favorite pictures on the wall, me shaking hands with Pope John Paul II and George W. Bush on the deck of the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished sign above it. I mean, that he died a Republican, right? And that was just, in 2006. So, I'm real familiar with that world and the people in it. And for a while I shared that worldview. I mean, the thing that changed me was coming of age during the Vietnam era and coming to the conclusion as I, 16, 17 years old, that my government was A, lying to me, and B, wanted to kill me, and had killed several of my friends, who got drafted, sent off to Vietnam, and came back in boxes. Yeah. And that's a real revelation for a young person. And then you start really questioning everything. And that's when I really, that was kind of the beginning of my genuine political education.
Do you see that today with this generation? With the Gen Xers questioning the established norms and pushing up against them and not necessarily buying the lines that prior generations have bought since the days of the early days of the baby boomers?
Yeah. I had thought that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars might accomplish something very similar to what Vietnam did, but because there's no draft, and it was an all-volunteer
army. There's no skin in the game. Yeah,
exactly. And I think probably the Israel-Gaza situation is radicalizing young people more than anything else. There was also, of course, that moment. The George Floyd moment and the Black Lives Matter movement. But it hasn't generalized, and the blowback. I mean, now we've got Republicans running around going, "We got to get rid of DEI," and stuff like this, which it's just really just really, you want to stop teaching the racial history of this country? You want to stop teaching the gender history of this country? It's frankly pathetic. But I think that, you know, William F. I used to sit and watch, you know, my dad and I used to watch Firing Line together back in the late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. And Buckley famously said that a conservative is a man who stands athwart or stands astride the arc of history with his hand out shouting, stop. And in other words, you know, yes, we want to move forward, but we want to do it carefully, thoughtfully, step by step. That was Eisenhower's conservatism.
Right.
That was not Reagan's conservatism. Reagan was a reactionary. Reagan was actually trying to reverse things that had happened. Let's roll back the union movement. Let's mm-hmm. roll back this high tax rate that is keeping the wealth in the middle class and preventing the emergence of a super wealthy class. And so I think that we're seeing a lot of pushback, like I said earlier, to that Reagan movement, to that Reaganism, to the neoliberalism. And the big terrible mistake that the Democratic Party made, really the Clinton administration made, although, you know, like I said, last year, Carter's administration, he kind of bought into it too. It was a very seductive, you know, Milton Friedman did a good job. I wrote a book about this, the hidden history of neoliberalism. You know, the idea that somehow the free market is going to magically, you know, help everybody. And it turns out that there's literally no such thing as a free market. Markets are created by government. You know, it's like saying, let's have a free football game. Oh, what does that mean? Well, there's no rules because it just magically always works out. And if one team wants to pay an extra $50 to the ref so that he always throws things their way and have an extra four guys on the field, you know, that's the free market. You know, hey, they got the extra money they can do, you know, so to say that. You know, you can say, in business, we're just going to do away with the rules and we're just going to, you know, let the people with the most power make.
Which is the case that Trump is making now. That's why he wants to roll back a lot of the regulations. Yeah,
exactly. And it doesn't work. It makes things worse. It destroys middle classes. It destroys economies for everybody except the top 1% over time. And I think it's unfortunate that you asked before, you know, why are liberals or why are Democrats so bad at messaging on this stuff? And I think that there's almost a kind of a personality characteristic here that conservatives tend to, and George Lakoff talks about this, you know, the strict father model versus the nurturing family model. But mm-hmm. but I think it's more like, you know, within the GOP in particular and the conservative movement that emerged in more in the 80s, because I don't think this was the case during the Eisenhower era, there's discipline, there's leadership and messaging flows from the top down. And the Democratic Party, by and large, particularly because of all the chaos that was created by the adoption of neoliberalism by the Democrats in the 90s, has just been atomized. It's been fractionalized. It's been factionalized.
Right.
So you've got.
Well, let's have a food fight first, and then
you know, this group is worried about, you know, you've got gender issues, you've got racial issues, you've got religious issues, you've got, you know, economic issues, you've got union issues, you've got international issues. And, you know, the GOP would look at all those things and they'd say, okay, let's pick the top three that we can use to beat the crap out of the Democrats. And that's all we're going to talk about. And once we get enough power, we'll do all that other stuff.
Hello.
And the Democrats, on the other hand, say, oh, let's talk about all this stuff. And as a result, the message just, you know, it's you're pissing into the wind. I mean, the message just gets spattered all over the place.
You just nailed it, Tommy. It's so expertly, because that's exactly what it is. I mean, I've been saying it for the last month or so in a number of the conversations I've had with Democrats. It's like, guys, you're making this way more complicated. You want to know why the Supreme Court is where the Supreme Court is? It's because we focused on it for 25 years. And while you guys were focusing on the policy of abortion, we were just talking about getting the court. We just wanted to animate the base to get the court. Because once you got the court, all these other pieces then fall in place. Chevron falls in place. Campaign finance falls in place. All the other pieces fall in place. So
voting rights.
Voting rights. And for some of us inside the tent, if you will, who have tried to resist that, it became a losing battle after a while. And thus you see the Liz Cheney's and others just being jettisoned out of the party, set aside in big ways that, you know, sort of cements this idea. To your point, what you see happening right now under Joe Biden, not a consolidation of the left around the idea of here's a bigger threat than this guy or our policy disputes. So let's focus on that. It is still trying to hammer out a solution or an answer to a policy or other issue that right now the country's like, you know, dude, this guy just sounds stronger than your guy. And if that's where you're going to leave this, you're going to get clobbered in November. And it's interesting that, you know, you had the Heritage president, whom we had on our show the weekend on MSNBC a couple of weeks ago, Kevin Roberts, who made just this week on a follow up to that somewhat controversial interview, noted that right now the country is in, as he put it, the midst of a second American Revolution that will be bloodless. And here's the tagline. If the left allows it to be, how should the left respond to that?
Well, it's a statement that implies violence, and I think that there's a lot of recoiling, a lot of horror in response to that, and even Republicans I think are starting to back away from it. I think one of the reasons why Trump just came out and repudiated Project 2025 is because, you know, people are starting to realize how extraordinarily reactionary this is. I mean,
draconian,
you know, this is,
and un-American it is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, to the extent that I could characterize Reagan as a reactionary, he had nothing going compared to these guys. You know, these guys want to turn America into Hungary, basically, you know, into something like
Well,
Putin's
Viktor Russia. Orban is the model. He is the model.
And I, you know, I've written and talked about that at length. And this illiberal democracy idea is, you could argue it's the logical outcome of neoliberalism, of Reaganism, but it will destroy this country. It just absolutely will destroy this country. And if our democracy goes down, I mean, we've already seen about a 15% decrease in the number of human beings on Earth who live in democratic countries just over the last two decades. You know, that Francis Fukuyama back in, what was it, 97, you know, wrote The End of History and The Last Man. You know, everybody's going to become democratic now. And it's
not so much.
The rich people stepped in there and said, now we're going to take it.
Oh, no, there's no money in that. There's no money in
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I see a reaction. I would like to see the Democratic Party get more organized and get their act together. It's very frustrating.
I agree with you. I mean, look, we could probably do a whole podcast just on the Reagan era alone and its impact. We could do a podcast on the Johnson era and the impact it had, and the same is true with Eisenhower. And I think that what the country, I think, misses and sorely needs are the conversations around those types of ideas and issues that flowed out of those periods. Whether you agree or disagree with Reaganomics or trickle down or whatever, there were significant policy prescriptions, discussions, ideas that were pushed back and forth. And it is the introduction of the politics exclusively as a matter of solution to those big questions where this thing started to go sideways very quickly. And that for me was the late 80s. It was really what we saw emerge in the House under Newt Gingrich's leadership, in which it became much more terra firma. We are going to
transport.
There you go. Make it a blood sport in order to change the landscape. And what would you say as we kind of wind down our conversation here to this generation of young liberals, young progressives, young conservatives about the state of our politics and the role that they can play beginning this November in setting, resetting the course, resetting the table, resetting the outlook for this country so that a progressive and a conservative in the future can have that debate as opposed to one of them, maybe perhaps both of them, which how I think it plays out, being locked up because of what they believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And there was that era that, you know, that I lived through as a young person by and large, where you could have policy discussions and still be friends. You could even understand the other person's point of view and not view it as evil. What I would say to young people, I've got a book coming out in September, the Hidden History of the American Middle Class. Mm-hmm. And it's about how the middle class was created. Middle classes are not normal. You know, what is normal is the world that Charles, economically, if you have laissez-faire economics, what you normally have is the world that Charles Dickens wrote about. Yeah. You know, Scrooge was not the top 1%. He was the middle class. He was the middle class was the doctors, the lawyers, and the merchants. And they were 2 or 3% of the British population. And then you had the top 1%, you know, the royal family and their friends. And then you had this 95% poor working people. That's what a normal economy, that's what, if you have an unregulated economy, that's what is always going to be produced. You can see that in any country around the world through 500 years of history. Mm-hmm. Middle classes have to be created by government policy. And the main part of that is government policy giving power to working people, which is by, you know, legalizing unions and things, as we talked about earlier. So what I would say to young people right now is it's all about the power. It's really, you know, you're not going to, you know, if you want to have the things that countries like, you know, Northern European countries, you don't have to go into debt to go to college. They pay you to go to college. You get a $300 a month stipend in Denmark to go to college or in Germany. And it's completely free. You know, I was just talking in Riga, Latvia, a couple of days ago to a woman who was telling me how she had broke her ankle on an icy street and spent, you know, a month in the hospital because she had 4 bones that were shattered and they had to put all this metal in and do all this stuff. And then 6 months of Riga. And I was like, wow, what did that cost you? And she says, oh, it was terrible. It's 103 euros for the whole thing. And it's like, I mean, this is a country, 2 million people and, you know, Latvia and, you know, and we can't do that in America. So if you want to have a country where things work, if you want to have a country where you actually have a functioning middle class, where people can become socially mobile through education, where families, where you don't have, I mean, last year there were 580,000, I think was the number, medical bankruptcies. Mm-hmm. In the Western world, among all the democracies of the Western world, the 34 OECD countries,
right,
all of them occurred in the United States. We're the only country that does this to people, right?
Holy crap!
And you know why? Right? Why? Because we've been having it's kind of that Newt Gingrich blood sport politics. Because and it's a lot of it is being driven by, frankly, I think people who are, you know, born into wealth or have acquired wealth and also have a mental illness called obsessive compulsive disorder / hoarding disorder, that if they hadn't been rich, they would have a department full of tin cans and newspapers up to the ceiling. They're just, but instead of collecting newspapers and tin cans, they're collecting money because they have the ability to do that. And there's just never enough. They've got, you know, I've got $100 billion. Well, now I have to have $200 billion. It's like, how much money do you friggin' need to live, right? So, and I don't mean to sound like a Marxist because I'm absolutely not. I'm a fan of capitalism. I've made a lot of money in my life, and I've started and run 5 different businesses and built them up and sold them off and done very well for myself. Thank you very much. But all that said, you can't just, you know, we can't just like be so atomized and so fractured and so at war with ourselves. And I'm talking about the left here, you know, the progressive left. We have to figure out how to acquire power. And that's through the the political process. Right. I mean, and that means taking control of government, and it has to start at the local level. And there's been just a lot of really smart decisions made on the right in the 1980s. I mean, you got 1,500 right-wing radio stations right now, and you know, fewer than 100 left-wing ones. I mean, there's at least commercial ones. I'm on a couple hundred non-commercial ones as well, but and of course SiriusXM and other things. But the point is that the right built out a messaging infrastructure and then use that messaging infrastructure to basically take over. And, you know, back in 2006, I think it was when I was on Air America Radio, a group of us.
I vaguely remember Air America.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was going well. I mean, we had problem was we leased 54 stations from Clear Channel. And we were in all the major markets in America. I was beating Rush Limbaugh regularly on Air America. But then, you know, Mitt Romney wanted to become president. And so he had his company buy Clear Channel and they just took us off the air. And so a bunch of us went to Washington, D.C. And Bernie Sanders, in fact, helped organize this meeting with a bunch of members of the House and Senate, who were concerned about these issues. And we made this pitch, you know, you guys know a bunch of billionaires who, you know, we spend $1 billion every 4 years on an election. Why don't you buy some of these radio stations so that we're not at the mercy of Mitt Romney any longer, and build out a messaging infrastructure. And one of the senators who later ran for president got up and said, this is really, you know, what you're talking about is a bad idea. This should be the free market. You know, you're interfering in the free market here. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. It's about the power. And if you're going to, you know, you've got to have a messaging machine, you've got to have an organized message. And it's got to be one that you can back up with history, that you That's can it. Say, you know, here's how it worked before, we can get back to it. You know, it's a part of the brilliance of Reagan with his Make America Great Again slogan, right, which Trump stole. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of work to do on the left. I don't know. I'm starting to ramble here now, Michael.
I think it's not a ramble at all. And I think for a lot of conservatives, we look across the aisle and go, "What the hell are they doing? Are they seeing the same thing we're seeing? How are you talking about this issue that way, or why aren't you talking about this issue at all?" And it really does go to the heart of what you said, Tom, is creating that messaging machine. And just as a point of, because I think we're both students of history here, just as a historical footnote to the point you made about, you know, the emergence of that sort of conservative communication, a lot of that was born out of the fact that for a long time, a lot of conservatives didn't hear their points of view reflected by Uncle Walter, you know, Walter Cronkite at 6:30 every evening. So they turn on the national news and our views on the Vietnam War, our views on the economy, our views on the social construct, particularly given the sexual revolution that was going on and the women burning their bras and dads sitting there watching their daughters come in and taking their bras off and burning them. Like, what the hell is going on? There was no place to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And so this
other than the Joe Biden show.
Yeah, they right.
If you remember.
Yeah, exactly. They created that space.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yes, liberals tried to do that with Air America, but then when they ran against, you know, the least little bit of turbulence, they're like, oh my God. And the whole thing kind of falls apart. And so I think you make some very important points, and it's really not rambling as much as it is pointing to looking at various things that when you connect those dots, you begin to see the pattern of behavior, which is not necessarily led to the point you're ultimately making is in order to have power, you have to take power. In order to take power, you have to win elections. In order to win elections, you've got to have a message that gives voters the reason to give you the power. And so that's how we've looked at it since my early days in Republican politics. That's how I cut my teeth. And here's the irony. You'll love this. You know who I learned a lot of that from? Democrats like
Yeah,
Marion
like
Barry
Franklin Roosevelt. Oh, yeah.
yeah, like
Oh, yeah.
Marion Barry, the former mayor of Washington, Joe Yeldell, the former first one of the first black city councilmen appointed by Lyndon Johnson. So they understood the streetwise aspect of what we're talking about and
Well,
translated
LBJ himself, too. I
LBJ
mean,
himself.
there was a man who took names and kicked ass.
Yeah, exactly. And Democrats today are not only afraid to kick ass, they won't even take the name down. So I think, and yet, and still, they'll turn on Joe Biden.
Which is
So
sad.
anyway, so you make some excellent points, man. I could talk to you, and I know you're in the middle of some travel, but I appreciate your taking time, and I could spend a lot more time with you. Definitely, here is a standing invitation to come back when the book is out this fall, talking about the middle class, because I really think that is the heartbeat. And here's a little tip to what we're talking about. Republicans have figured that out and have already started messaging to the middle class, because
Oh, yeah.
they actually know what's on the back end of this. And if we can lock in the middle class around these culture war issues that we're talking about, certainly the political issues, the economic piece becomes a little bit easier to tic-tac-toe into it. So you've got your finger on an important pulse. The question is, how do liberal slash progressive Democrats begin to translate that into political success? And that's what I'm interested to reading how you articulate they do
It's a big challenge.
that. All
That's the
right.
big.
That's the big, yeah, you're right. So Tom Hartman, he is the host of the live daily program, the Tom Hartman program. You hear it from what, noon to 3 p.m. daily on commercial radio stations all across the United States, more than 7 million listeners a week tuning in and listening to a very smart guy. Tom, I really appreciate you taking time for what I know is a busy schedule for you to have a little bit of conversation and fun with me here at the Michael Steele Podcast.
Michael, it's been an honor, like I said, and a privilege, a real pleasure talking to you and getting to know you. And thank you so much for inviting me on.
Absolutely. So I look forward to having you back when your book on the middle class comes out. We can talk about that, break it down. Between now and then, folks, I need y'all to do a few things to get ready for this election. I need you to get registered. I need you to get activated, and I need you to wear the big D on your chest. You figure out which D I'm talking about. Democracy or Democrats? I don't know. Which one am I talking about? Anyway, until next time, guys, be safe, be well, take care of yourselves out there. Have a great summer. See y'all in about a week.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.